But what we want to talk about this afternoon is what advocacy is and what the rules are. And for many of you and most of you in this room that are with nonprofit organizations, and some of you that are with academia or with large, huge, you know, multi-billion dollar entities, some of you may be with small organizations with fairly small budgets. But regardless of the size of your organization, regardless of the type of organization, it's really important that you be advocates and that you be public policy advocates, and particularly be public health advocates. That as you and as we talk about what the terms mean, and as we talk a little bit about what advocacy is, and talk about why and advocacy matters, it's really important to think about what advocacy does. And it helps bring about systemic change. And so there are a lot of times if, you know, for the work that you're working on, if you want to try to have, you know, everybody in this country insured, that as we found out, we're not going to do it by businesses by themselves, by every employer providing coverage, or by health insurance companies suddenly opening their doors, that we need to have laws and we need to have public policies in place to let that happen. It's also important to think about that a lot of advocacy is not just us going to Congress or us going to our state legislatures or our local legislatures or foreign legislatures and asking for something. A lot of what advocacy is us providing information to the decision makers who are going to be making laws. It's sharing the knowledge that we've learned, it's sharing the stories that we've learned, and it really is telling those stories. That too often I think we assume that the policymakers know the issues and we just don't understand why they just don't make the right decision. And a lot of times they just have no idea. Even if they know something about healthcare policy, they may not know the specific issues that you're working on. And frankly, they may not even know that it's an issue. And so it's really important for you to not assume that they know, but to go in and to tell them what you care about. And sometimes you'll get sort of these faces like, really? I had no idea. You know, sometimes they won't necessarily be interested in what you have to tell, but we can't assume and we can't ask our legislators to do the right thing or to pass good laws or to make good decisions if we're not there telling them what we think they should be doing. And we can't assume that they know that. And we have to rest assured, and you have to know that the other people, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or the other kinds of industries or employers or whoever else, is out there telling what they think and is out there telling legislators and out there telling policymakers what they want to happen. And so it's really important that you're there and that you're there talking about the work that you're doing, but also that you're there as the voice of the people and the constituents and the clients and the communities that you work with. That very often nonprofit organizations, again, whether it's an academic institution or whether it's a small neighborhood health clinic, you are the voice or you are the conduit between the decision makers and the people that you're working with. They may not feel comfortable. They may not have the time to take off to go meet with legislators. They may not feel that they know enough when they do, but very often you may be their advocate and you may be their voice. And so it's really important to take advantage of all of the opportunities that you have. And it's important to know that as nonprofit organizations, you can get involved in public policy. You can advocate, and you even can lobby. One of the biggest misperceptions in the nonprofit world and in the public policy world, and we see this all the time in newspaper stories and talking to legislators, is, well, they're with a nonprofit, so they can't lobby. And that's just hooey. Nonprofits can, it's a very technical term. Nonprofits can lobby. There are some limits to what we can do. There are some limits to how much we can do, and we'll talk about those a little bit. But organizations can lobby. And we'll talk in more detail in just a minute about what some of the federal rules are that govern lobbying, which govern all organizations as nonprofits. And again, one of the reasons that I asked when to open this up of to where what organizations you're with. Because depending on the type of organization, the rules will vary. So those of you or the one person, and maybe now there are a few more people with state agencies or work for government, there are some additional rules on what government employees can do in terms of lobbying. In terms of there are some different rules in what for-profits can do, and there are different rules in what nonprofits can do. And then even in the world of nonprofit organizations, depending on the type of whether you're a 501c3 organization or whether you're a labor union or a 501c4 organization, there are limits on what you can do. And if you have no idea what those numbers and letters mean, you will in a few minutes. So it's important to understand the type of organization you're with because the rules will vary. That said, there are some rules that govern all organizations, no matter whether you're a for-profit, no matter whether you're a hospital, no matter whether you're a university, no matter whether you're a small local neighborhood clinic. And these rules come in several forms. One is that federal funds, so federal grants, federal contracts, cannot be used for lobbying. So if you have federal contracts, you have to really look at, in general, those funds cannot be used for lobbying. You still can engage in advocacy. You still can talk about the issues that you care about. You still can talk about public health issues like obesity or the problems of secondhand smoke. And there are, in fact, many government agencies actually give out grants for policy purposes. But the funds can't be used for lobbying. And that's something that applies to all types of entities, whether for-profit, not-for-profit. And so it's just important to know that. It's also important to know that there are some rules at the state level. So if you are working with an entity that's trying to influence state-level policy, each state, or most states, have their own sets of laws dealing with lobbying. These laws at the state level don't care, again, whether you're a for-profit organization, whether you're a not-for-profit organization, or what type. At the state level, they want to know if you're trying to influence what government does. They want to know who you're talking to and what you're talking about. And these, at the state level, are disclosure regimes. They have their registration and reporting regimes. And again, it applies to any kind of entity that is trying to influence policy at the state level. And each state has their own sets of rules and their own definitions, their own thresholds of what need to be counted. For those entities that are doing a significant amount of work trying to influence federal policy, so trying to influence what Congress does or influence what the Department of Health and Human Services does, for instance, there's also a Federal Lobby Disclosure Act that, again, applies to all entities, regardless of whether you're for-profit, not-for-profit, 501c3. Again, it doesn't matter. It's a system that requires organizations that spend a certain amount of money each quarter and have at least one employee that spends a significant portion of their time have to register at the federal level as well. These rules don't apply to organizations that occasionally come to D.C. and go to a Hill Day. So if you're planning to go to the Hill Day later this week, that by itself won't make you have to register under the Lobby Disclosure Act. So don't worry about that. If you sign on to a letter here and there, that won't make you have to register under the Federal Lobby Disclosure Act. If you send around to your constituents some letters or some action alerts that come that Lucy and her colleagues generate, that won't make you have to register at the federal or state level. It's when you're engaged in significant amount of work that counts. But what we're going to be talking about for the most of this afternoon has to do with the federal tax rules, which govern most of you in this room as not-for-profit organizations. And my organization, as Lucy said, I'm with an organization called Alliance for Justice, and we are based here in Washington, D.C., and we have an office in Oakland, California as well. And we work with organizations primarily nonprofit organizations to educate and to provide guidance about why advocacy is so important and what those legal rules are. But as I said at the beginning, there's so many misconceptions about what nonprofits can and can't do regarding advocacy. There's some seats up front, so come on in. And so we want to make sure that misunderstanding of those rules don't stand as barriers between organizations getting involved. And in the back, I provided a brochure about our work, this little red brochure called Make Democracy Work, that talks about the workshops that we do, and we do have regular online trainings. We have a whole series of publications, and we also have a technical assistance line. And so if you have questions at times, and again, we're going to be taking questions today, but if you have other questions that come up, know that you can call us at any time, and that number is 866-NP-LOBBY, 866-NP-LOBBY, or you can email us at advocacy@afj.org. We also, and we put a few other materials on the back table as well. I'll also circulate a few sign-in sheets. If you're interested in signing up to be on our email list to find out about new publications or new resources that we have, feel free to sign up. And we just released 2 or 3 weeks ago a new guide about influencing public policy in the digital age that talks about, well, what do you do when you put things up on Facebook? Or what about if you're using Twitter? What do you do with that? Does that count as lobbying? Are you doing that as an individual? Are you doing that in your work capacity? So as I started, I was starting to throw out a lot of letters and numbers talking about nonprofit organizations. And that's because the nonprofit sector is really guided by the tax code. I know when all of you joined nonprofit organizations, whether, again, it's a local health organization, whether it's APHA, whether it's academia, you did not do it because you cared about tax law. I'm sure I'm probably one of the only people, you know, can say that. But tax law really guides and determines what these types of nonprofit organizations can do. And there are a lot of different types of nonprofit organizations, or what are considered to be tax-exempt organizations, and the most common of which are on this chart. So the most common type of nonprofit organization are 501c3 organizations. And these are groups like Alliance for Justice or the LCV Education Fund. Harvard, Yale, universities are 501c3 organizations. Many research institutions are 501c3 organizations. Many hospitals are 501c3 organizations. These are the charitable, religious, scientific, educational organizations. And they run the gamut from really small, all-volunteer organizations to entities like Harvard and Stanford Stanford, I guess, is a public institution, but Harvard and Yale with, you know, billions and billions of dollars and lots of assets. 501c3 organizations are tax-exempt, so they don't have to pay federal income tax. But they have some great other fundraising abilities. 501c3 organizations are eligible to receive tax-deductible contributions. And they're one of the few types of organizations eligible to receive tax-deductible contributions. So when 501c3 organizations raise money, they're able to put on their website and on fundraising letters, contributions are tax-deductible, and individuals or corporations that give are able to get a tax deduction for that. That is a huge benefit of being a 501c3 organization. And it's huge from the small neighborhood organization up to the universities and the hospitals, that they rely on that charitable tax deduction to be able to raise money. In addition, 501c3 organizations tend to receive funding, or the primary source of funding, from foundations, from entities like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Ford Foundation. Those foundations are also 501c3 organizations, but they're in a different category, and they have to spend at least 5% of their assets each year for charitable purposes. And the most common way that they do that is by making grants. And so as 501c3 organizations, we really have this preferred status in terms of being able to raise money. Not that it's easy to raise money, but just think how much harder it would be if you weren't eligible to receive foundation grants or individuals did not receive that tax deduction. But as a result, there are some limits in what we can do. And 501c3 organizations are limited in terms of our advocacy activities. And those limits come in two forms, in terms of lobbying and election activity. Now, as 501c3 organizations, as I said earlier, we can lobby. We're subject to some limitations on how much lobbying we can do, but we can lobby. And I'll come back and talk more about what the definition of lobbying is. Because, again, it's important that under federal tax law, there's a fairly narrow and a fairly precise definition of what counts as lobbying. And if the activity doesn't meet that definition of lobbying, then it's not subject to the limits. And then you can do as much of it as you want. So understanding what counts as lobbying is really important. But as 501c3 organizations, it's also really important to know that we cannot support or oppose candidates for public office. So as 501c3 organizations, we can't support candidates, we can't endorse candidates, we can't give money to candidates. Now, when I'm talking about this in terms of what we as 501c3 organizations can do in terms of lobbying or even in terms of election activity, I'm talking about what the organizational resources, how the organizational resources can be used. And so what you as staff of the organizations can do in your staff role, during the workday, using the organizational resources. So when I say that you, as 501c3 organizations, we can't support or oppose candidates, that means I, as Abby Levine, as Legal Director of Advocacy Programs at Alliance for Justice, cannot support candidates through my work. But as an individual, over the weekend, I certainly can go to fundraisers and go to other kinds and participate in other ways. And so it's important as we talk about the rules on lobbying, and we won't get into today, just for the interest of time, election activity, but it's important to think about that there is a difference between what you can do as a staff member, sort of, or what you do in your official role with a 501c3 organization versus what you can do as an individual. And there are differences, and we can talk more about those. But again, there are other types of tax-exempt organizations. There are labor unions, which are tax-exempt under Section 501c5 of the tax code. There are social welfare organizations, or what are called 501c4 organizations. There are trade associations. So the American Medical Association is tax-exempt under 501c6. And those, the C5s, the C6s, you follow the same rules as the C4s. They are also tax-exempt, but contributions to them are not tax-deductible. So it's much harder for C5s, C6s, C4s to raise money, and they tend to do so by membership dues or by people who really care about an issue. But they can do more advocacy. So they can do as much lobbying as they want, and they can also support or oppose candidates. So it's important to know that even while you as C3 organizations may be limited in being able to talk about candidates or to be able to, in terms of the election, there are other types of organizations that can. And it's important that when you're asked to participate in certain events or certain campaigns certain advocacy efforts, that you're clear about what the goal is, and that you might be asked by a union that you do a lot of work with, that you have similar ultimate goals, but they may be, because they can support candidates, they may be intending to. And so you just want to make sure that you're staying within the rules for 501c3s. But as we talked about, we can lobby. So it's important to understand what counts as lobbying and what doesn't. And again, I can spend hours talking about this, and I have spent hours talking about this, and you'll be glad to know I will not here. So this is sort of the condensed version. And one of the handouts that's in the back is a sort of one-page handout that goes through and defines what lobbying is. But under federal tax law, essentially, lobbying is communicating with legislators to express a view about specific legislation. And they've actually broken it down into two types of lobbying, into direct lobbying and grassroots lobbying. And not all organizations use this breakdown, that there are, in terms of the lobbying limits, there are two ways that organizations can determine what their limits are. There's what's called the insubstantial part test, which comes directly from the tax code that says you as a 501c3 organization can qualify to receive tax-deductible contributions as long as a substantial part of your activities is not to influence lobbying. Well, that sounds good, right? The only problem is they've never actually bothered to define it. They've never actually bothered to define lobbying, or they've never really bothered to define what substantial means. So we know that we can engage in a substantial amount of lobbying, but we're not quite clear sort of what those either of those rules are. The other test that organizations can use to determine their lobbying is what's called the 501H expenditure test, where organizations have to fill out a form and tell the IRS, I want to be subject to this expenditure test. And then there are definitions, which are the definitions that I'm going to talk about, because these really are the only definitions. For many organizations, the 501H expenditure test is really useful because it looks at how much money the organization spends. Under that insubstantial part test, it looks at all of the activities of the organization. So for most organizations, or many organizations, the 501H expenditure test is really useful, except for many of you in this room, except for many of you who are with academia. Because under that 501H expenditure test, there is a cap on how much money organizations can spend on lobbying. And that cap is $1 million. So no matter how large the organization, can never spend more than $1 million on lobbying, which for most organizations that I work with, that's not a problem at all. You know, they wish they had $250,000 to do anything. But for academia, for institutions of higher education, you can imagine that $1 million might be eaten up pretty quickly, because it's not just academia, or it's not just $1 million in one department. It's the entire institution. And so for many of you, you actually may be operating under this insubstantial part test, where we really don't know what counts as lobbying. And so it's important to go back, if you are going to be doing a fair amount of weighing in with government officials, to go back and talk to your at your university, whether the head of your department or the general counsel's office, to just get a sense of what they're counting and what doesn't, and what kind of reporting or what they need to know from you about what you're doing. Because again, it's a pretty large, you know, insubstantial for universities, that's still pretty large, but it's important to sort of check in with your counsel's office just to make sure they know what you're doing and that you're on the same page, so they're not surprised at the end of the year when they have to file the tax returns where they have to report this. So we're going to talk about the definitions that apply to those organizations that do use the alternative test. But these are the only definitions that we have. And these are the definitions that even the large organizations tend to look at to try to figure out what counts as lobbying. So we have these two types. We have direct lobbying, which is what you would be doing if you went up to the Hill this week to talk to legislators about legislation. And then there's grassroots lobbying, which rather than you as staff or rather than the organizations itself communicating with legislators, you're urging the public to contact legislators. So in order for something to be lobbying, so for it to be direct lobbying, we need to have a communication with the legislator that expresses a view about specific legislation. And all three of those elements need to be met. So the first is we need a communication. And that seems clear. I mean, you can sit around the conference room in your agency and talk to your colleagues all you want about what Congress should do. But if you never tell anybody, well, clearly you're not lobbying. So the first element that we need is a communication, whether it's a phone call, whether it's a letter, whether it's a fax, whether it's a tweet, or whether it's cake. that these are types of communication. Now, just because it's a communication doesn't mean it's lobbying. Again, we need to go through all of these elements. But in the example on the left of these cakes, this was a number of years ago when Congress was considering Medicare reauthorization. And they did not have a provision in the bill for prescription drug coverage. And the AARP thought that was a key missing piece. So they sent a cake up to every member of Congress that said, RX and Medicare now, add the missing piece. That is a communication. Now, sadly, this probably violates the House ethics rules and the Senate ethics rules now, but this was a communication. But then we need to look, okay, so it's a communication, but it still needs to be to a legislator that expresses a view about specific legislation. So then the question becomes, well, who's a legislator? Now, even though we're talking about federal tax rules, these rules apply at every level of government. So they apply to members of Congress, they apply to members of your state legislatures, they apply to members of local legislatures, and frankly, they apply to international legislators as well. So if you're trying to influence policy in parliament or in the Israeli Knesset, that's considered influencing a legislator. And it includes the elected members themselves and their staff. But there are a few other people who are sometimes considered to be legislators. And I think when Congress, who wrote these rules, you know, they didn't quite listen to or think about all the civics lessons that we all learned in school, where we have our three equal branches of government. Because they can sometimes consider the president to be a legislator. That under federal tax law, a legislator is defined as a government official who participates in the formulation of legislation. So in what capacity does the president participate in the formulation of legislation? Signs bills, exactly, or vetoes bills. So generally, if you were communicating with the president, he would be the chief executive. But if you were urging him to veto a bill or to sign a bill into law, you would be communicating with him as a legislator. And the same holds true if you are communicating with him about his budget, something that is needs to be, that goes through Congress, that is legislation. And the same holds true to sort of cabinet officials. So for most of the time when you're dealing with folks at HHS or other government agencies, they are not considered to be legislators. But if you are communicating with Secretary Sebelius about legislation, where she's involved in drafting that legislation, you would be, and the main purpose of that communication is to influence the legislation, she would be considered to be a legislator. So for instance, as I was looking at the APHA's website, found that they had a letter that they had submitted to her, or that they had submitted to the president, urging him to protect important discretionary health funding as he works with congressional leaders to help to develop a deficit reduction package. So they're communicating with the president, but the purpose of that communication is what should be in legislation and what kind of deficit reduction package, which is legislation, should be passed. So the purpose of that letter was legislative. So the president for that purpose would be a legislator. But there are some people who are not considered to be legislators. There are some people who are even elected who are not legislators. And that are what are considered to be members of special purpose boards. And again, the tax code never fully defines these entities. They say they're administrative bodies. So school boards, water commissions, planning commissions, entities that usually make policy but don't have full legislative authority. They are not considered to be legislators. So as an organization, you could try to influence the school board, and it's not considered lobbying because you're not communicating with legislators. So in this example, if an organization is working to try to influence the school board to change their vending machine policies of not putting soda in, that might be public policy, that might be advocacy, but it's not lobbying because you're not communicating with a legislator. In general, when we're talking about legislators, we're talking about, you know, people who are elected, people who are part of our legislative bodies, except when we're talking about ballot measures or referendum, constitutional amendments. There, it's the general public who votes on whether they pass or not. So usually when we're communicating to the general public, we would fall under that grassroots category, except when we're talking about ballot measures. But so we need a communication to a legislator. But simply communicating with legislators is not enough. So some of you, when you may be going to the Hill this week, you may be meeting with your legislators. You may not be lobbying. You will be lobbying if, while meeting with them or their staff, you express a view about specific legislation. If you go and so what is specific legislation? Now, clearly specific legislation are bills that have been introduced. Bills that have names, bills that have numbers, that's clear. So if you go and talk about a bill that's pending, whether it's a tax, whether it's a budget appropriation, that's specific legislation. If you go meet with a legislator and urge them to introduce a bill, that's also expressing a view about specific legislation. And frankly, so is if you go and urge them not to introduce a bill or not to support a bill that's not yet been introduced. That's also expressing a view about specific legislation. Or confirmations, executive branch or judicial nominees that have to be confirmed by the Senate. That is specific legislation. Going in and talking about ideas of that there's a problem in your community, there's a public health issue, and it needs to be solved, and the way it needs to be solved is by Congress passing a bill to do X, Y, and Z. That would be expressing a view about specific legislation. On the other hand, if you go and meet with your legislators, again, whether here in D.C. or at your state or local level, and you talk about the issues of concern in your community, and you talk about problems of childhood obesity, or you talk about poor air quality, and you tell them what the problems are, that is not lobbying. You let them know about the research you're doing, and you let them know about the work that you're doing. That's not lobbying. You go in and say, well, we have this problem about childhood obesity, and we need to find a way to get our kids healthier. And there are a whole lot of ways we can do that. And we've been thinking about whether to try to encourage families to spend more time outside with their kids, or whether we can get some of the local privately owned parks and pools to provide free days. Or we can try to get some of the local businesses to make healthier food cheaper. So you go in and you talk about a whole variety of ways to maybe address this issue. That's probably not lobbying. But if you go in and say, we have this problem and we need you to pass a law that prohibits schools from serving soda, now you're talking about specific legislation. So again, when you go meet with legislators, just because you're meeting with legislators doesn't mean you're lobbying. It depends what are you talking to them about. And there's a whole lot where you may go and tell them about what you're doing, what you're seeing, what the conditions are that are not lobbying at all. Now, one thing that's important to note, that if you go in and you go to meet with a legislator and you say, well, I'm going to go in and just talk to them about what we're finding and about what we see, but and I'm not going to talk about specific legislation, but you go in and you're meeting with them and they say, huh, that research is really interesting. Well, I've been thinking about introducing this bill. Do you think that would be helpful? If you answer that question, you are now expressing a view about specific legislation. That may be lobbying. But again, the question often then becomes, so what? That if you are lobbying, you don't have to panic. The world doesn't end. But again, those of you with 501c3 organizations and other nonprofits can lobby. It's a matter of degree of how much you're doing, which is why it's important for you to check in with your organizations, check in with your compliance officer, general counsel. They're not as scary as, you know, you may think. Or call me and we can talk about, you know, again, what those limits are. Because again, you can do it. And you might be in that meeting where you may not intend to lobby at all, and they suddenly come to you with this idea, and you would be silly not to lobby in many cases. And so again, it's important to know when you are lobbying so you know when you need to track it, when you might need to tell somebody. But if you are lobbying, don't panic. It's not cause for concern. So that's what direct lobbying is, where you're communicating with legislators to express a view about specific legislation. But another type of lobbying is what's called grassroots lobbying, or some people call it indirect lobbying, where rather than you communicating with the organization communicating with legislators, that's where you send out an action alert. You put something up on your website and say, call your legislator, tell them to vote no on this bill. You put something out on Twitter. You put something out on Facebook. Those are communications to the general public. Now, for grassroots lobbying, we still need a communication. It needs to be to the general public. It needs to express a view about specific legislation. But there needs to be a call to action. Putting something up on a website that talks about the importance of funding. So in this instance, this is a letter that's on the website for the American Heart Association. As your constituent and as an advocate for the American Heart Association's You're the Cure Network, I urge you to make increased funding for the National Institutes of Health and NIH-supported health and heart and stroke research a top priority. A significant increase in funding will allow the NIH to improve health, spur economic growth and innovation, and advance science. Now, is this lobbying? If you were to write this letter and send it to a legislator, that would be lobbying. That's direct lobbying. You're communicating with a legislator to express a view about specific legislation. But if you simply put this up on your website, that is not lobbying. Talking about the importance of a bill, talking about why legislation is good or bad when you're talking to the general public, by itself is not lobbying. In order for it to be lobbying, there needs to be, there needs to be what's called a call to action, where you actually need to say, call your legislator, write your legislator, here's their phone number. So putting something up on your website, putting something up on Facebook, talking about why a bill is useful, is not lobbying. It only becomes lobbying when you're communicating to the public when you have a call to action. So when you say, contact Congress on Twitter, congressmen and women are on Twitter to hear from people like you, tweet your representative and senators and tell them to co-sponsor the Toxic Chemical Safety Act. That is a call to action. It's also a call to action to list the phone numbers or the other contact information for legislators. So in this example, it's talking about legislation that's stalled. We need to encourage them to end the war in Iraq. And the following U.S. representatives are members of the House Appropriations Committee. Now, listing the members and their contact information. Listing the members who are part of a committee who will be voting is a type of call to action, and so is listing their contact information. Once you have one call to action, assuming those other elements are met, it's grassroots lobbying. So generally, you're going to say, call your legislator, tell them to contact write your legislator, tell them to vote yes on this. Here's their phone number. You're usually not going to see a call to action that just has the phone numbers or just has email addresses or just lists who's going to be voting. Because what's the point of that? You might as well say, tell them to vote. Or the other kind of common call to action is a form where you provide a way for people to automatically contact their legislators. So in order for communication to the general public to be grassroots lobbying, there needs to be one of these calls to action. If there is not a call to action, it's not lobbying. So again, as an example, here we have, let's say this is a billboard, and it's this big billboard on the streets, on the highways, that says, the more these cost, the less they'll smoke. Tell the legislature, raise the cigarette tax. Call the Maine legislature and provide the phone numbers for the House and Senate. Protect our kids, not big tobacco. Now, would this be lobbying? Yeah. It's a communication to the general public. It expresses a view about specific legislation, raise the cigarette tax, and it has a whole bunch of calls to action. Tell the legislature, call the legislature, the phone numbers. So this would be grassroots lobbying. But let's say the organization still wanted to get its view about the cigarette tax out. But for whatever reason, your organization could not lobby. or you did not want to lobby. You could still, does that mean you have to sit quietly and not say anything? No, you still could put up a billboard. We could change this billboard. So now the billboard says, the more these costs, the less they'll smoke. Raise the cigarette tax. Protect our kids, not big tobacco. We still have a communication to the general public. It's still expressing a view about specific legislation. But there is no call to action here. You would hope somebody would read this and say, oh, I should call my legislator and tell them to raise the cigarette tax. But there is no call to action here, so this is not lobbying. It is not lobbying. Now, what you could not do is you could not put a web address at the bottom of this, or a Twitter something, or you know, a Facebook page, where somebody goes to that and up comes, call your legislator, tell them to raise the cigarette tax. That'll be attributed back to the ad. But this by itself is not lobbying. Now, there are a few exceptions. If you were to run this, if you were to put this billboard out within 2 weeks of a vote. But in general, if you don't have a call to action, it's not lobbying. So it's important to look at what you put on your website, what you put on Twitter, what you put on Facebook, that you could be talking about bills. You could even be talking about whether they're good or bad, and it's not necessarily lobbying. And one thing that I just want to go back to that I can't believe I jumped over this in my, as I'm going forward, that when we talk about what is specific legislation, as I mentioned, specific legislation, and this applies to both direct and grassroots lobbying. So specific legislation is something that has to be voted on by a legislative body. So again, whether it's the budget, whether it's a tax, whether it's a confirmation that needs to be voted on by the Senate, whether it's a bill, whether it's a resolution. Even if it's a non-binding resolution, it's still, if it has to be voted on by the legislative body, it's still specific legislation. But there are a lot of types of government policymaking that is not specific legislation. And again, when we're talking about what counts as lobbying, it's communicating with a legislator to express a view about specific legislation, or it's communicating with the general public to urge them to contact legislators about specific legislation. So if we don't have specific legislation, it's not lobbying. So some things are not considered to be specific legislation. And the first, and very powerfully, are regulations or rulemakings. So when a legislature is considering a bill, and you're weighing in on what that bill should look like, that would be lobbying. But once the bill has been passed and it goes to the agency to implement it, all of that rulemaking, and that's often where the rubber meets the road. That's where the terms are defined, the parameters are set. That is not lobbying at the federal level. So you could weigh in with the agency about, you could comment, you could testify before committee hearings at the agency about what the agency should do, and that's not considered to be lobbying. Likewise, you could seek executive orders. And again, because an executive order is issued by the executive, by himself, without having to go to the legislature, it's not considered to be legislation. So again, thinking about what you want to get done, thinking about groups who are working, trying to get more stem cells available for research. Sort of Congress was not a very hospitable route. And so they got the president to issue an executive order. Weighing in on whether to vote for that is not considered lobbying. Seeking enforcement of existing laws is not considered to be specific legislation. So again, once a law has been passed, it is weighing in on the enforcement of it is no longer specific legislation. And finally, engaging in litigation is not considered to be specific legislation. So you could challenge a law. You could bring suit and say, oh, this law is racially discriminatory, or this law is being inadequately funded, and that's not specific legislation. You could even go meet with a legislator and say, you know, Congressman, I know you are the sponsor of this bill. Isn't it a shame that it's really not being implemented? Could you weigh in? Could you get, you know, use your bully pulpit? Could you use your reputation to try to get this moving? That's not lobbying. So you could even be asking legislators for something, and it's not considered to be lobbying. So So here's some examples. So again, here's an example of various organizations submitting comments to the Food and Drug Administration when they were to the Tobacco Products Scientific Advisory Committee. That is not considered to be lobbying. Likewise, the American Cancer Society filed a brief in support of the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act. It's litigation, not considered to be lobbying. As you see my theme here on smoking, an online complaint form that the District of Columbia has, if you see restaurants or other businesses that are violating the ban on indoor smoking, you could file a complaint. You could encourage other people to file complaints. You could, as a public health organization, you could publicize this and urge people, if you see violations, to file complaints and to empower people to be able to make sure these laws are being enforced. Or you could seek executive orders. So again, there are a lot of ways that you can try to influence public policy without it being considered to be lobbying. And then finally, there are some activities that meet the definition of lobbying, but for various policy reasons are not considered to be lobbying. And the first that I'll talk about is what's called a nonpartisan analysis study or research. And this is where an organization creates a report or does an analysis. Often there are sort of written reports, but they don't actually have to be, where you're looking at an issue. And the report has to have what's considered to be a full and fair discussion of the issue. So you can't just say smoking's bad because I said so. No, you need to have facts behind it. And you need to broadly disseminate the report. In the day and age of the internet, that's really easy to do. Plop it up on your website. Send it out to the media. Really easy to do. Assuming you do that, you can express a view. You can even say, based on the research that we've done, we think a bill is necessary to do X, Y, and Z. And that's not considered to be lobbying because it's part of this larger study, this larger discussion, this larger analysis of the issues. So there are ways, and there are a lot of organizations that put out reports and a lot of health-based reports looking at issues. Should we require immunization? Should we, you know, at what age? Where you can look at sort of the pros and the cons and then ultimately draw conclusions and say, this is what we think the legislature should do. And it's not considered to be lobbying. Now, if you were to take that and go meet with legislators and say, you know, we've done all this research and we think you should introduce a bill, now that's direct lobbying. But the entire cost of producing that report won't be considered to be lobbying. Really powerful. A second exception that's really powerful for organizations is what's called the request for technical advice or assistance. So a governmental committee or a task force may ask the organization to provide your expertise and to participate in the legislative drafting process, or they may ask you to come testify and provide your opinions. Now, and you won't have to count that as lobbying. So you could be sitting in a congressional hearing room testifying before a legislative committee, which is what we think of sort of as the epitome of lobbying, and it may not actually count as lobbying. The key is that the request needs to be made on behalf of the committee. It's not enough that one friendly legislator invites you, and it's not that somebody, while you're talking on the phone, says, hey, what do you think? You need to be invited to submit testimony, whether in person or in writing, and the testimony needs to be made available to the entire committee. But assuming you get that invitation, and again, for academic institutions, that's very likely. And you can ask and say, we'd love to be able to testify. Could we get an invitation from the chair of the committee? This is ways that you could sit on task forces that may be drawing up recommendations, maybe making policy recommendations. And some of those policy recommendations may ultimately be to pass legislation. Organizations can do that because of this exception and not have to count it as lobbying. And then finally, one other exception is what's called self-defense. And that's if there were a bill pending or if there were a bill that you want that would affect the powers and duties of the organization, its tax-exempt status, or the deductibility of contributions. This isn't something that deals with funding. So if your organization tends to get funding from the CDC or NIH, and next year your budget is going to be zeroed out, going to arguing and saying, well, we need to preserve our funding, that doesn't qualify for self-defense. I think what could qualify is if there were a bill, and as we've seen in various states, that any organization that provides services to any undocumented person could be subject to criminal penalties. If you work in a health clinic where you provide services to anybody who walks in the door, and you could now be penalized for, you know, serving someone, you know, that may count towards your powers and duties of being a clinic that serves, you know, the indigent and anybody who comes in the door. Some of the proposals that have been pending about limiting the tax deduction to 501c3 organizations may qualify. So this doesn't come up a whole lot, and you would want to talk to your lawyer before you use this. And then finally, and sort of as a place to end, again, talking about issues is not considered to be lobbying by itself. So the examination and discussion of policy issues is not lobbying. If you're not talking about specific legislation, and if you don't have a call to action. So again, talking about the problems of childhood obesity, talking about the problems of lead paint, talking about the healthcare issues in your communities or the issues that you're working on, and raising the public's awareness of those is not considered to be lobbying. And as we know, in order for, you know, when we saw this with, you know, lead paint, and many, in order for, before any communities would pass laws to sort of prevent lead paint from being used, there was a whole lot of work that needed to be done to educate people about the health dangers of it. And so educating that, doing that groundwork of letting people know about issues, doing research to find out what are people worried about, how are people getting sick, all that kind of work is not considered to be lobbying. So there's a whole lot that you as organizations can do to talk about the issues, even though they may have something to do with policy. You can talk to government officials. You can talk to the public. You can talk to the media about issues that concern you, and they may not be lobbying. That again, remember that for lobbying, it's communicating with legislators to express a view about specific legislation or urging the public to contact legislators about specific legislation. So it's always important to think about, what are we talking about? Are we talking about specific legislation? And again, I know we've talked about a lot of material really quickly. If you have questions, feel free to call me or my colleagues, and we're here to help walk you through some of these issues. But the important thing is to be advocates. And again, even if you're not lobbying, lobbying is such a small portion of public policy that because regulations, executive orders, enforcement, litigation, is not considered to be lobbying, there's so much that you can do even if you're not lobbying. So it's important to understand what the rules are. It's important to understand what any internal rules and procedures you have in your organizations, but it's important to speak out. And I think the cost of not speaking out is greater than any cost in speaking out. So thank you. I will turn it over to Lucy, and then we'll take questions.